It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote the first draft of her autobiography, Pioneer Girl, in 1930. No publishers were interested, and lucky for us, they weren't, because Wilder tried again and published Little House in the Big Woods in 1932. And we all know that that was the beginning of something truly amazing. Now, that first book, Pioneer Girl, is finally in print. Pioneer Girl, the annotated autobiography, is available tomorrow. And editor Pamela Smith Hill is here with me today. Hello, Pamela.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And you are no stranger, of course, to Laura Ingalls Wilder. You're also the author of Laura Ingalls Wilder, A Writer's Life. So you've written her biography as well. What made you want to give people an opportunity to see this work in print?
The annotated edition of Pioneer Girl grew directly out of my biography on Laura Ingalls Wilder. When I was at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch, Iowa, researching my biography, I overheard a telephone call that an archivist received, and it was very clear that the person on the other end of the line was interested in Pioneer Girl. And I asked him if that was another Wilder scholar on the line, and he said no. He said, we field calls like this often from passionate Wilder readers. So I filed that thought away, and then when my biography came out, I, of course, quoted extensively from the rough draft version of Pioneer Girl, and readers began contacting me asking where I got access to the manuscript and how they could get their own copy. And it occurred to me that maybe it was time for Pioneer Girl, but a Pioneer Girl that placed the various versions of the Pioneer Girl manuscript into context, as well as relating it back to the novels. So I pitched the idea to the South Dakota State Historical Society Press, and then together we approached the executors of Wilder's estate in 2010, and they agreed.
This first version that makes up the bulk of what you have published here, this was a handwritten version of the autobiography that was completed in the spring of 1930. Let's talk about the circumstances that Laura Ingalls Wilder was living in at that point. She was living in Missouri and had just moved into a new home. And they were on the farm that they had moved to in Missouri. Can you flesh out the picture for us?
Right. Laura Ingalls Wilder and her husband, Elmanzo and Rose, moved to Mansfield, Missouri in 1894. They left Dakota Territory behind. And Wilder and her husband spent the rest of their days in the Missouri Ozarks. Both of them lived to be 90 years old. So the Missouri Ozarks became home for Wilder. Rose Wilder Lane grew up in southwest Missouri, but she never felt at home there. However, in the late 1920s, she returned to Missouri. She built her parents a retirement home. It was very luxurious for the time. We would think of it now as a two-bedroom bungalow, but it's very attractive and had all kinds of luxuries installed in the home for that period. And Rose Wilder Lane herself moved into the farmhouse that Laura and Elmanzo had so lovingly built from materials on the farm. So the two women were living in close proximity to each other. Laura Ingalls Wilder had essentially retired from her career as a farm journalist for the Missouri Ruralist. She stopped writing for that paper in about 1924. And I think Rose Wilder Lane perhaps thought her parents would simply retire. But for some reason that we aren't aware of, we can speculate on the reasons why, Wilder decided to write her autobiography. And as you've already mentioned, she finished writing it in May of 1930 and shared it with her daughter, Rose.
Now, this kind of paints a very happy, serene picture, moving into a new home, looking at the retirement years, having her daughter nearby. But it wasn't really an easy time. The nation was entering into the Great Depression, and Rose herself was fairly deeply in debt. She had borrowed money from a number of people to build that home that her parents were living in. So there was concern at the time, and she was having a hard time getting her books published, although she was a well-known author, right?
Exactly. Hard times had fallen on Rocky Ridge Farm and all across the nation, of course. Rose Wilder Lane in the 1920s had emerged as a very popular and successful writer. By 1930, she was already the author of several books of fiction and nonfiction, and she was a regular contributor to major magazines across the country. So she was a literary figure who was very well known. Of course, her mother, Laura Ingalls Wilder, was a relative unknown outside the state of Missouri. Excuse me. But Rose Wilder Lane was concerned about all of the expenses that she had incurred building the house. She built the house in 1928 before the crash, and she had plans to build a larger lodge for herself and had to put that on hold because of all the expenses. And then, of course, it was a tough time for the literary world, and by 1930, magazines were not buying manuscripts as readily as they had just a year or two before. So Rose Wilder Lane, as well as Laura Ingalls Wilder, were both concerned about the financial outlook for Rocky Ridge Farm and for their personal lives.
And you don't have access to really what Laura was thinking during that time. She was not keeping journals. She wasn't writing about her feelings. Rose did keep journals, and you are able to sort of trace some of the things that happened during that time through her words and the things that she recorded. She was an unhappy woman. She struggled with depression. She was frustrated with her career. She was frustrated with where she was in the world. She longed to travel and to be other places and to have adventures. So some of the lines that you quote that shed a little bit of light on her relationship with her mother and on the process of getting this book published or trying to get this book published paint a little bit of a bleak picture, but I think it's safe to say that what she was putting down in her journals would have been fairly negative anyway.
Right. Excuse me. It's kind of early out here, and I'm just now getting my voice back, so forgive me if I have to clear my throat a bit. Rose Wilder Lane was not a happy woman. She was, I think, very frustrated. I think it's interesting that she even considered building a large house for herself in the Missouri Ozarks because she was never at home there. She was never really happy there. In fact, she didn't finish high school in Missouri. Laura and Almanzo sent their daughter south to finish high school with Almanzo's sister, Eliza Jane Wilder. And Rose Wilder Lane really struggled off and on with her life in Missouri, and ultimately she left Missouri in the mid-30s and came back only to visit her parents. So she wasn't happy there. But in that particular time, in the spring and summer of 1930, Rose Wilder Lane was very concerned about her own career, and yet she just dove in to Pioneer Girl and began typing the manuscript right away. She made a few edits to the handwritten manuscript, and even before she had finished typing the manuscript, she sent the first few pages off to her literary agent in New York, asking for his opinion, and was actually delighted when he wrote back praising those first pages and asking to see the rest of the manuscript. So Rose Wilder Lane worked very, very hard on this first draft manuscript and was eager to sell it. We don't know if she was eager to sell it because she believed 100% in the manuscript and thought it was really strong and dynamic, or whether she was simply being practical and thought if they sold the manuscript, that would bring more income into Rocky Ridge Farm.
There was some interest in the manuscript, but ultimately nothing really came of it. Where did the idea of writing this story for children come from?
Well, I do want to backtrack just a little bit and say that there was some genuine interest in Pioneer Girl. Rose Wilder Lane's literary agent rejected the story ultimately. He did not want to represent it. He didn't believe in it at all. But Rose Wilder Lane still did, and she worked on a couple of other versions of the manuscript during the summer of 1930, and she took a polished adult version of the manuscript. And I think it's important that we clarify that Pioneer Girl was written for adult audiences. Mm-hmm. She took a very polished, highly rewritten and edited version of Pioneer Girl with her to New York in the fall of 1930, and she started shopping it around herself to various magazine editors and publishers. And she had a really close call with the Saturday Evening Post. The publisher of the Saturday Evening Post was intrigued with the manuscript. And I want to point out here, too, that at this point, although Rose Wilder Lane was a really well-known, well-established author, she had never published in the Saturday Evening Post, and that was kind of the leading magazine of the period. So the mere fact that she showed Pioneer Girl to the publisher of such a prestigious magazine probably indicates that she did, in fact, believe in it.
Right.
Ultimately, he rejected it. And I'll come back to that story in a moment. And while she was in New York, Rose Wilder Lane fired her literary agent, hired another one, and she convinced her new literary agent to represent Pioneer Girl. And her new literary agent showed it to a round of magazine publishers, all of whom said nice things about it, but ultimately rejected it.
And the idea of having it printed as a serial in a magazine was really attractive to Lane because it would have meant more income?
Right. At that point, it's kind of hard for us now in the 21st century to recall that magazines published both long-form fiction and nonfiction. And usually what an author hoped to do was to sell magazine rights first in serial form to a publication like the Saturday Evening Post or the Ladies' Home Journal. And if the serial was a success, then that manuscript could be repackaged to a book publisher. So basically, you sold your manuscript twice, first to a magazine publisher and then to a book publisher. So you earned income twice. That's really what Lane and Wilder were hoping for.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Pamela Smith-Hill. She's the editor of Pioneer Girl by Laura Ingalls Wilder, the annotated autobiography. It's coming out tomorrow, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Pamela Smith-Hill. She is the editor of the new autobiography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's not new, actually. It was written in 1930, but it has just been released. It comes out tomorrow. It's called Pioneer Girl, the Annotated Autobiography. And Pamela Smith-Hill has painstakingly researched this original manuscript and sheds light on the events of Wilder's life and really paints an amazing portrait of this woman and her family and the times that they lived in. You're welcome to join our conversation this hour, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And right now we're talking about the path toward publication that Laura Ingalls Wilder took. We'll also dig into the manuscript here in a moment. We'll talk about some of the differences between the autobiography and the books that we all know and love, the Little House series. So, Rose Wilder Lane, Laura Ingalls Wilder's daughter, has taken the manuscript to New York City. She's shopped it around. She's hoping to get it published in magazines as a serial and then later as a book. She has done some serious editing on this original draft. There were some changes that she made. And over the years, Pamela, some people have speculated that Rose actually wrote the series, the Little House series. I think that myth has been put to rest before, but let's also put it to rest today because it's very clear from your work that that's not what happened.
The two women worked very, very closely together. There's no doubt about that. They collaborated editorially. And as I pointed out in my biography about Wilder, when I took a look at their correspondence about the books, and they have a very rich correspondence about the writing of the Little House books, it became immediately clear to me that what I was looking at was editorial correspondence, the typical routine correspondence that a writer and her editor exchange. So Rose Wilder Lane was Wilder's editor, and I think there's nothing really unusual about the collaborative relationship between a writer and an editor, but what was unusual in this instance were two things. First, that they were mother and daughter. Very rarely do a mother and daughter collaborate, as these two women did on an important series of children's books, or any books for that matter. But also that this editorial collaboration was conducted essentially in secret, that Wilder's publisher at Harper and Brothers did not realize that Rose Wilder Lane was acting as her mother's editor. And I think it became very clear when, in correspondence, one of Wilder's editors at Harper and Brothers, the legendary children's book editor Ursula Nordstrom, once said that she never had to make a single change to any of Wilder's work. The manuscripts came in and they were perfect. So it's very clear to me, based on the correspondence between Rose Wilder Lane and Laura Ingalls Wilder, that the two collaborated together to make those manuscripts perfect before Wilder sent them off to her publisher.
And now let's return to the question, where did the idea of writing about Laura Ingalls Wilder's life in the third person for young readers, where did that idea come from in the midst of trying to get this manuscript published?
Well, it's something of a mystery. Rose Wilder Lane's journals are very, very short. Usually a journal entry has only 4 or 5 lines. And then somewhere during the summer of 1930, as she was working on revisions for the adult version of Pioneer Girl, a line appears in Rose Wilder Lane's diary, "Worked on my mother's juvenile," or "worked on the juvenile version of Pioneer Girl." And, you know, you're reading those diaries and you go, wait a minute, what? Where did this come from? And there's really no indication. There's no correspondence. There's nothing that indicates where or how the idea came about to create a Pioneer Girl version for young readers. But reading between the lines, I think I've kind of come to this conclusion. When Rose Wilder Lane was making her final edits and working closely with Laura Ingalls Wilder on the final adult version of Pioneer Girl, they took out big chunks of scenes from Wilder's childhood in Wisconsin, presumably because the two women felt that that material was too immature for adult readers, that it really wouldn't appeal to an adult reader of the Saturday Evening Post, for example. Excuse me. So those passages all went on the chopping block. But those were really good stories. And presumably unknown to Laura Ingalls Wilder, Rose Wilder Lane kind of strung together a manuscript, a very short manuscript, centered around those Wisconsin memories. And she sent them off to someone during the summer of 1930. Her diary doesn't indicate to whom she sent this material, but it's probable that she sent the manuscript to her good friend Berta Hayter. Berta Hayter was a children's book illustrator and writer who was enjoying the beginning of a very long and illustrious career as a children's book writer and illustrator. She and her husband went on to win Newbery Awards. So presumably, Rose Wilder Lane sent the manuscript to Berta Hayter, and Berta Hayter, in turn, began circulating the manuscript very quietly to her contacts in children's publishing in New York. Now, this first version of the juvenile Pioneer Girl, as we now call it, was still written in first person. We now know it as the manuscript When Grandma Was a Little Girl. And the whole piece was written from the perspective of an older woman looking back on her childhood. Nevertheless, an editor at Alfred Knopf was very interested in the manuscript, so that by early 1931, she met with Rose Wilder Lane in New York and said and asked for a revision to the manuscript. She didn't ask for a contract. She asked for a revision. And this editor suggested that the manuscript be written in third person, that Laura Ingalls Wilder scrap the idea of a grandma looking back on the world and centering the story firmly in the heart and mind of its young protagonist. And Wilder was, I think, surprised to find out that there was a juvenile version of Pioneer Girl, but she tore into the revisions, revised the manuscript herself, moving it from first person to third person. I know that sounds technical, but it was an important distinction. And eventually, the editor at Alfred Knopf offered Wilder a three-book deal on the strength of that first manuscript. Now, unfortunately, this was, of course, still the Depression. And before Wilder signed the deal, Alfred Knopf decided to lay off its entire children's book department. The editor at Alfred Knopf was still so committed to the manuscript, which by this time was known as Little House in the Woods, that she showed the manuscript to one of her colleagues at Harper & Brothers, Aunt Virginia Kirkus. And Virginia Kirkus was interested in the manuscript and made an offer to Wilder.
Such an incredible, fortunate move at that point, having an editor who was so in love with the work that in spite of the fact that she was losing her job, she wanted to make sure that it got published.
I think that's really remarkable. I think it's remarkable, too, that on the strength of this one revision from an unknown writer, this, I think, very daring and insightful editor at Alfred Knopf offered Wilder a three-book deal. Now, Harper & Brothers didn't follow up with a three-book deal. In fact, Wilder had to negotiate one contract at a time for the remaining books in her series. But Alfred Knopf and that editor there, I think, saw in Wilder a unique and fresh and enduring voice. And, of course, they were right.
Let's dig into this manuscript a little bit now that readers are getting an opportunity to see what she originally meant to write about her life. Could you read us a little bit from the very beginning of Pioneer Girl?
Right. I'll read you basically an opening scene. And as I talk about in the annotated edition, you kind of can see that in the beginning of Pioneer Girl, Laura Ingalls Wilder is still kind of writing in the format of a columnist. So we have short, brief scenes and vignettes that are almost the exact length in terms of word count as the column she had written for the Missouri Ruralist. So I'll give you an example of that here on the opening pages. Once upon a time, years and years ago, Pa stopped the horses in the wagon they were hauling away out on the prairie in Indian Territory. "Well, Caroline," he said, "here's the place we've been looking for. Might as well camp." So Pa and Ma got down from the wagon. Pa unhitched the horses and picketed them, tied them to long ropes fastened to wooden pegs driven in the ground so they could eat the grass. Then he made the campfire out of bits of willow twigs from the creek nearby. Ma cooked supper over the fire, and after we had eaten, Sister Mary and I were put to bed in the wagon, and Ma and Pa sat a while by the fire. Pa would bring the horses and tie them to the wagon before he and Ma came to sleep in the wagon, too. I lay and looked through the opening in the wagon cover at the campfire and Pa and Ma sitting there. It was lonesome and so still with the stars shining down on the great flat land where no one lived. There was a long, scared sound off in the night, and Pa said it was a wolf howling. It frightened me a little, but we were safe in the wagon with its nice, tight cover to keep out the wind and the rain. The wagon was home. We had lived in it so long, and Pa's rifle was hanging at the side where he could get it quickly to shoot the wolf. He wouldn't let wolves nor anything hurt us, and Jack, the brindle bulldog, was lying under the wagon guarding us, too, and so we fell asleep.
That's Pamela Smith Hill reading from Laura Ingalls Wilder's autobiography, Pioneer Girl, now being published as an annotated autobiography out tomorrow. And of course, when we hear that passage, you mentioned she was still writing like a columnist. That's several chapters of Little House on the Prairie there five paragraphs.
In fact, in the very next paragraph in Pioneer Girl, she says that Pa built a house of logs. And in Little House on the Prairie, Wilder devotes multiple chapters to this one paragraph that about Pa building a house of logs.
The story that she writes in her own autobiography is so much, it's briefer, but it's also so much more complicated than the story that she chose to tell as the fictionalized version of her life. I mean, Pa and Ma and Laura and Mary and Carrie move a lot in that series of books, but they move twice as much in real life, right?
Right. And I think, too, what's interesting, if you look at the real Ingalls family's journey through the upper Midwest and West, is that they backtracked a couple of times, and in one very critical instance, they moved east and not west. So I think Wilder was very clear about the fictional direction she wanted her family to move in, and that was always west and always toward optimism and hope, rather than backtracking and going back to their beginnings or back to their roots and having to start over. She wanted to make sure that this was an archetypal, almost mythic family moving west, facing adversity with courage and optimism.
I think the way that she fictionalized her life shows an incredible amount of insight and understanding for what readers would respond to.
I think you're right, and I think the key to Wilder's gift as a writer is, of course, the voice that she adopted in the Little House series. It's very warm, it's very personal, it sounds very childlike, and yet it ages believably along with its main character. Yet the writing is also very eloquent and beautiful, but the voice was the key into the characters, and Laura Ingalls Wilder understood her characters and their motivations extraordinarily well, far better than Rose Wilder Lane did. Rose Wilder Lane's gift was in the technical aspects of writing, structure and point of view and beginnings and endings and the level of detail that Laura Ingalls Wilder needed to bring to her work. But Laura Ingalls Wilder understood her characters, their motivations and their stories very clearly, and was able to really project that into the voice of her novels and into the hearts of young readers.
In reading the autobiography and comparing it with the series of books, I was confused at first. The family heads to Indian Territory or Kansas from Missouri.
Right.
And then returns to Wisconsin. And so much of what happens in Little House in the Big Woods actually happened after what happens in Little House on the Prairie.
Right. Laura Ingalls Wilder's earliest memories were in Kansas. She was born in Wisconsin. It's possible that the family moved from Wisconsin to Missouri. We know that Charles Ingalls owned some property in Missouri, and the immigration patterns into Indian Territory tended to be from Missouri into Kansas at the end of the Civil War. So it's very possible that the Ingalls family moved into Indian Territory from Missouri. So they were in Kansas. That's where Wilder's first memories occurred, and then the family moved back to Wisconsin. And when Wilder was working on the Little House series, this change in sequence was a problem. And, of course, it really originated with Rose Wilder Lane when she extrapolated those sections from Pioneer Girl, those scenes in Wisconsin, and sent them off probably to Berta Hayter, the children's book writer and illustrator. So Wilder was kind of stuck right from the beginning with a totally fictional chronology for her family, because she couldn't begin to start the series over once Little House in the Big Woods was such a hit. So she had to find a way to manipulate her own personal story in a way that would work for the sequence of her fiction and also would be believable and interesting to young readers.
In her original autobiography, she's already a little confused about what age she was when certain things happened. I can only imagine that confusion grew as her fictional persona aged in a different way as well.
It's really interesting to read the correspondence between Laura Ingalls Wilder and Rose Wilder Lane by the time they were mid-series, particularly when Laura Ingalls Wilder wanted to start by the shores of Silver Lake. I'm having an early morning problem, by the Silver Lake book. At that point, Wilder knew that she had to deal with big chunks of her life that she had chosen not to write about. So she skipped over 2 years between the Plum Creek and Silver Lake books. And so the two women were trying to figure out the right chronology and how old the fictional Laura was compared to the real Laura. It was really a very confusing kind of situation for them. It was confusing literally as well as in a literary sense. How do you make the story move ahead in a credible, believable fashion when we're skipping big chunks right. of real life and chunks of chronology, and we're going to ask readers to make that leap along with us? So it was a very challenging literary experiment.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Pamela Smith Hill. She's editor of Laura Ingalls Wilder's autobiography, Pioneer Girl. It comes out tomorrow. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Her autobiography was written back in 1930. It was never published, and now it is coming out in print for the very first time in an annotated version. Pioneer Girl, the annotated autobiography, was edited by Pamela Smith Hill, and she is on the line with me today. I was talking before about some of the remarkable changes that Laura made to her story when she turned it into a fictional version. And I think it showed such incredible insight and understanding for what readers would connect with. And also, I wonder if she was also speaking to young Laura, things that perhaps she wished had happened. One of the details that I discovered from your book and was surprised to see because of the role that he plays in so much of the stories is that the dog Jack, that good old bulldog Jack, wasn't with her family for all that long. He traveled with them to Kansas Territory, and when they returned to Wisconsin, Pa sold the horses and Jack went with the horses.
Right. I have to confess that when I was reading the rough draft version of Pioneer Girl for the first time, and of course I was reading it on microfilm, looking at this very, very dim image of tablet paper and pencil and the cramped writing of Laura Ingalls Wilder's handwriting, I had to reread that passage two or three times. I had a very hard time convincing myself that Jack didn't really travel with the family all the way into Minnesota. That just astounded me. And I think many readers find Jack to be a very deep, moving, and credible character. And when he dies in the opening pages of By the Shores of Silver Lake, his death is really important. It's very moving in its own right, but it signals that Laura herself has come of age, that she doesn't have Pa or Jack to look out for her anymore. So Wilder used the character of Jack very strategically through the novel. And I think the fact that she created such a deeply moving, credible, and believable canine character out of Jack signals to us today that she was really a very strong, astute, and strategic writer.
Absolutely. Now, one of the large time leaps that she makes in the series is very important to those of us who live in Iowa, because
right.
she skips her time in Iowa. And she did write about her life in Burr Oak, Iowa, in her autobiography. It was not a very happy time in her life. It was not a very easy time in her
right.
life. Can you tell us a little bit about the time that she spent here?
The family moved to Iowa after the grasshopper plague in Minnesota. Basically, Charles and Caroline Ingalls gave up on farming, and they moved east with another family from Walnut Grove, Minnesota, and decided to manage a hotel in Burr Oak. Basically, I think the Ingalls family had reached the end of their financial rope when they moved to Iowa, and they were very, very desperate. The hotel did not work out. Charles and Caroline had a very difficult time making ends meet while they were there. To add to their difficulty, on the trip out of Minnesota into Iowa, their infant son, Freddie, had died. He was only 9 months old. And to be honest, the Ingalls family just weren't really very happy with Burr Oak, Iowa. In Pioneer Girl, Wilder quotes Pa as saying that Burr Oak was an old town, that it lacked the spirit and life of a Western town. And so they didn't linger long in Burr Oak. They moved to Burr Oak, Iowa in 1876 and left in 1877.
During that time in Burr Oak, though, Laura saw a lot of things that she hadn't seen before. I mean, they managed the hotel. The hotel was right next to a saloon. There was a lot of drinking. There was quite a lot of violence. She witnessed domestic abuse. The family that they were with at first, the mother, she described her as constantly shaking and harassing her youngest child, who was always crying. I mean, this was a kind of a new world for her in many ways.
It was a new world, and it was a very disturbing one. Wilder makes quite clear, however, that her parents, Charles and Caroline, weren't entirely happy with the situation. Certainly, Laura and Mary had to do their share of chores at the hotel. So they saw more things than I think Charles and Caroline were comfortable with, and the family eventually moved out of the hotel and into rooms over a grocery store. But it was a coming-of-age period for young Laura. When she decided to write about her life in fictional form, and when she got to that point where she should probably have talked about Burr Oak, she and Rose wrote about it and kind of argued about whether the Burr Oak episode should be part of the Little House series. And Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote back that the Burr Oak and part of the Walnut Grove experience formed a story in and of itself. It was not part of the picture she was trying to paint of the fictional family, so she decided not to include it there. And I think a big reason may have been because thematically the family moved east, not west, and that Charles Ingalls gave up on farming for that period of his life. And of course, the fictional Charles Ingalls never loses sight of being a farmer and homesteading and building a home for his family on the land. And I really feel Wilder felt that that period in Burr Oak would undermine that portrait of her father and her family.
She also skips through Mary's illness, the illness that takes Mary's vision. Mary becomes blind, and in the books she says that she had scarlet fever, and it got into her eyes, and she lost her sight. In her autobiography, she says that Mary had a stroke.
Yes. There's a great deal of correspondence between Rose and Laura about the novel By the Shores of Silver Lake, which is where time kind of catches up with the fictional Laura. And this would be the book where Mary would become ill and go blind. And Wilder was very clear that she didn't want to dwell on unhappiness, that she didn't want readers to be looking back and mourning with the family. She wanted them to be moving ahead and being excited about the journey into Dakota Territory. So Rose and Laura kind of, they argued, in fact, about whether to include Mary's blindness in the Little House series at all. Rose Wilder Lane felt that Mary's blindness was too grim a topic for children's literature in the late 30s and early 40s. Laura Ingalls Wilder argued that she could not bring Mary forward in the story if Mary wasn't blind, and she felt that children would understand and appreciate the family's resolve and courage in the face of this adversity. But she didn't want to dwell on it very much. Now, nothing exists to explain why they settled on scarlet fever. The girls had had scarlet fever, but much earlier. And actually, Laura had had the more serious bout of scarlet fever. But I suspect that they chose scarlet fever because it was a quick and easy solution. Scarlet fever was a serious childhood illness. And, of course, it had played a major literary role in another children's classic, Little Women. So I think they settled on scarlet fever just because it was a quick and easy solution. That way Wilder could at once discuss Mary's illness and introduce it as a topic, but then quickly move on to the family's transition into Dakota Territory.
There is a line in one of your annotations that I just loved, and this is from Wilder to Lane. She wrote, or told, I'm not sure, this is from the Lane papers, but Pa was no businessman. He was a hunter and trapper, a musician and poet. And in the autobiography, we get an even deeper sense that he was a restless man and not good at making money.
Exactly. Exactly. And yet I think Wilder loved him for all of those reasons. And I suspect from Charles Ingalls, Wilder herself became the storyteller that she was, that she learned the craft of storytelling from her father. And I think, too, the other thing I want to point out about Charles and Caroline Ingalls is that although they weren't particularly good at making ends meet, they valued education, music, and culture, and all of that comes through very clearly in Pioneer Girl. And one of my favorite little vignettes in Pioneer Girl actually takes place in Burr Oak, and the girls are at home. They're reading from their independent fifth reader, and outside, unbeknownst to the girls, a crowd is gathering to listen to them read. Charles and Caroline Ingalls valued education, and I think that also contributed to Wilder's value of books. She became a passionate reader herself and then ultimately a writer. So certainly Paul was a poet, and perhaps because he was a poet and not a businessman, we now have Laura Ingalls Wilder, the beloved children's book author that we can all treasure and enjoy.
Would you read another passage for us from the book? I feel like her voice gets stronger and stronger as it goes on.
It does. It seems as if, as you move through Pioneer Girl, it seems as if you can track Wilder's growth as a writer, that she kind of breaks free from the constraints of being a columnist, and she moves into writing fuller, more deeply created and fulfilling scenes. So I'm going to read from a passage kind of midway through Pioneer Girl that deals with the grasshopper plague. And I'm just going to read you a short passage, and I will say this, that she develops the scene much fully. That this passage continues over several pages, not simply one page. The weather was just right, and the crops grew and grew. At dinner one day, Pa was telling us that the wheat in our field was so tall it would just stand under his arms with long, beautiful heads and filling nicely. He said the grain was all soft and milky yet, but was so well grown, he felt sure we would have a wonderful crop. Just then we heard someone call, and Mrs. Nelson was in the doorway. She was all out of breath with running, wringing her hands and almost crying, "The grasshoppers are coming, the grasshoppers are coming," she shrieked. "Come and look." We all ran to the door and looked around. Now and then a grasshopper dropped on the ground, but we couldn't see anything to be so excited about. "Look at the sun, just look at the sun," cried Mrs. Nelson, pointing to the sky. We raised our faces and looked straight into the sun. It had been shining brightly, but now there was a light-colored, fleecy cloud over its face, so it did not hurt our eyes. And then we saw that the cloud was grasshoppers, their wings a shining white, making a screen between us and the sun. They were dropping to the ground like hail in a hailstorm, faster and faster. They will to ruin crops, all ready to eat to wheat," cried Mrs. Nelson, forgetting her Norwegian accent in her excitement. Our dinner was forgotten.
Her descriptions of the environment are so beautiful in that series of books, the Little House series, and you do also get glimpses of that in the autobiography. She doesn't spend as much time describing the environment, but we do get a little bit of a hint of how much she loved the world around her. Even when she became engaged to Almanzo, she said, "I wasn't sure if I was engaged to him or to the sky and the prairie."
Right, right. In Pioneer Girl, Wilder does write convincingly about the landscape she sees. And I want to share just one very brief passage with you and your listeners today. It's a breathtaking passage. She used the passage later in her fiction, By the Shores of Silver Lake. This passage appears in a slightly different form, but I think the first draft, rough draft version of this passage is its most beautiful, and I just think it takes your breath away. The sun sank lower and lower until, looking like a ball of pulsing liquid light, it sank gloriously in clouds of crimson and silver. Cold purple shadows rose in the east, crept slowly around the horizon, then gathered above in depth on depth of darkness, from which the stars swung low and bright. I think that's just perfection. And I think most of us as writers could only aspire to write so beautifully in a rough draft manuscript.
I know that she wrote this with a pencil on pads of paper, but so much of it does seem polished.
It does, surprisingly so. And yet, in Pioneer Girl, we decided to not to correct her spelling, not to correct her punctuation. We wanted readers to have the sense that this is how Wilder wrote, and this is rough draft. Now, most writers, myself included, would absolutely cringe if we had to share our rough drafts with the world. But in this instance, I thought it was important for readers to experience Wilder's unique, very personal voice without the benefit of editing, so they could see the kind of writer that she was and draw their own conclusions about her.
Well, and if every rough draft was this good...
Yes, indeed.
We'd all be very, very fortunate.
Right.
So I know that a lot of people will love to see this work. The annotations that you add in give us so much context, so much information about the rest of the family. I learned so much about Carrie and Grace and, you know, so many things that are so fascinating. But what do you think it really gives to people for them to be able to see this work, to read this work as she wrote it in 1930?
I hope readers will come away with the sense that they've heard her life story directly, that they have the sense, as I did when I first read Pioneer Girl, that I was sitting at Laura Ingalls Wilder's kitchen table, listening her tell the story of her life in her own words in a very intimate and personal way. And for me, that was the charm of Pioneer Girl and its strength. And then secondarily, to see how Wilder grew as a writer and how her life actually shaped her fiction. Too many of us, I think, still live with that legendary concept that Wilder just sat down and wrote down the facts of her life and that was it. But Pioneer Girl shows us that she worked very hard at her craft and that she was a mistress of her material,
right.
That she was an important writer of American fiction.
Pamela, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Pamela Smith-Hill is the editor of Laura Ingalls Wilder's autobiography, Pioneer Girl. It's coming out tomorrow. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.